Dr. B. R. Ambedkar Open University presents Education at Your Doorstep, a program of learning for everyone.
Well, listeners, we now bring you a lesson from English for third year students titled Translating the Greek Classics into English by Dr. Sridhar.
Translating the Greek classics into English. In this lesson on translating the classics, we will look into 1. The meaning of the terms classic and classics. 2. The reason for the translation of Greek classics. 3. A brief history of the translation of Greek classics into English. 4. How they were translated, that is, the theoretical assumptions behind the kind of translations we have. And the last, the questions pertaining to translations that they raise. Let us first try to understand first the terms classic and classics. A classic, as we know, is a work of art that deserves to be considered one of the best or the most important in a given field. We often refer to some book or film as a classic. We associate high quality and lasting value with a classic. When we say classics in the plural, we mean ancient Greek and Roman language and literature, the study of which was considered necessary for every educated person, for these are said to embody works of high quality and lasting value. We will now consider why Greek classics were translated into other languages, including English. As we have said before, the Greek classics are literary works of high quality and lasting value. As such, others felt the need to translate them into their own languages. The translation of Homer's epic, Odyssey, from Greek to Latin is considered the first recorded translation of a literary text and dates back to 240 BC. The importance accorded to the study of Greek and Latin in the West is similar to the significance of the study of Sanskrit in our own country. As the classics happen to be some of the earliest texts to be written, they have also become models for literary texts in other languages. Greek and Latin classics also define the conventions of literary forms like the epic, ode, tragedy, etc. in other European languages. Even if we think of an example of a departure or a deviation from conventional literary form like the mock epic, the point of reference for its discussion will be the classical epic. We will now look at a brief history of the translation of the Greek classics into English. When we think of Greek classics, the names of Homer, Sophocles, Aeschylus, Aristophanes, etc. come immediately to mind. As it is not possible for us to deal with the entire history of translations of Greek literature into English, we will confine ourselves here with some significant translations. George Chapman, an English poet and dramatist, published his translation of Homer's Iliad into English in 1598. This remained the standard translation of Homer's epic for almost two centuries. Alexander Pope, English poet, satirist, and critic, also translated the Iliad and published it between 1715 and 1720. Richmond Latimore's translation of this classic was published in 1951. Robert Fitzgerald's translation of Homer's Iliad came out in 1974. Pope and Cooper translated Homer's Odyssey too. Robert Browning translated Aeschylus's Agamemnon. David Green and Richmond Latimore have translated the complete Greek tragedies between 1954 and 59. Apart from being competent translations, all these translations also raise many questions on theoretical and practical questions concerning translation studies. Let us now consider how the Greek classics were translated into English. As with many other translations, Greek texts too had two distinct types of translators. There were those that attempted to bring the translation and its reader as near to the Greek original as possible by preserving its literal sense, idioms, etc. These were called Hellenizers. As against these, there were those translators who wished to produce an English equivalent to the Greek texts. They attempted to make the translation read like an English text. They were termed modernizers. In the preface to his translation of Aeschylus's Agamemnon, Robert Browning says he prefers a literal translation on the whole, except where the translation seems to do violence to English. He wishes to give, I quote, the very turn of each phrase in as Greek as English will bear, unquote. In other words, the English text should follow the structure and style of the Greek text to the extent that English allows it. Chapman and Pope, who translated Homer's Iliad, do not wish to translate word for word, but take a more liberal view in attempting to preserve the spirit of the Greek text. There seems to be a tendency to move once again as close to the originals as possible in the more recent translations of Greek texts. Green and Latimer translations of the complete Greek tragedies attempt to capture what they call the lyrically charged, rhetorically unaffected manner of the Greek texts. Let us consider now two versions of the first few lines of Homer's epic, Iliad, into English. The first done by Alexander Pope and the other by Robert Fitzgerald. First, Alexander Pope's version. Achilles's wrath to green the direful spring of woes unnumbered, heavenly goddess sing, that wrath which hurled to Pluto's gloomy reign the souls of mighty chiefs untimely slain, whose limbs unburied on the naked shore devouring dogs and hungry vultures tore, since great Achilles and Atreides strove, such was the sovereign doom and such the will of Jove. Now, Robert Fitzgerald's version. Anger be now your song, immortal one, Achilles's anger, doomed and ruinous, that caused the Achaeans loss on bitter loss, and crowded brave souls into the undergloom, leaving so many dead men, carrion for dogs and birds, and the will of Zeus was done. Begin it when the two men, first contending, broke with one another, the Lord Marshal Agamemnon, Atreus's son, and Prince Achilles, among the gods who brought this quarrel on. Homer's epic was intended as an oral text and was meant for common people. One of the characteristics of an oral text is its repetition of words. Even a cursory glance at Pope's translation will tell us that it does not seem to be for the ordinary people, nor does it use the device of repetition. The second example, by Fitzgerald, takes some of these aspects into account. There is, for example, the repetition of the words. Fitzgerald says, anger be now your song, immortal one, Achilles's anger. Notice again the repetition in the expression, loss on bitter loss. The language, too, is much more down to earth than Pope's. While Homer is supposed to have used many more repetitions in his text, Fitzgerald uses only some, not to make his translation sound monotonous. Latimer's translation of Homer's epic is much closer to the original, for he retains most of the stylistic devices of the original author. Just because of these differences, we cannot say that one translation is better than the other. Each translator may have had his or her own reasons for translating in the manner he or she did. Shall we now see what questions pertaining to translation these translations raise? In his preface to his translation of the Iliad, Chapman says that it is, I quote, pedantical and absurd, unquote, to translate an author word for word. It may be pertinent to remember here that Chapman uses the word interpretation for translation. It is but natural that he calls upon translators to follow Horace's advice to concern themselves with the materials of the source text rather than the number and order of words, and to clothe and adorn their sentences with the words and style which is appropriate for the language into which they are converted. Mark the word converted, which brings the notion of conversion, which suggests appropriate changes of the object converted. In the preface to his translation of the Iliad, Alexander Pope also refers to the translator as an interpreter, but he does not recommend any liberties to be taken, except those that are necessary for translating the spirit of the original and supporting the poetical style of the translation. He in fact suggests that the translator follows Homer's footsteps. I quote Pope, "Where his diction is bold and lofty, let us raise ours as high as we can, but where his is plain and humble, we ought not to be deterred from imitating him." To achieve this, the translator has to be very competent. This also places a tremendous amount of responsibility on him or her. Matthew Arnold has written an essay entitled On Translating Homer in 1861. He suggests that a translation should affect us in the same way as the original may have affected its first readers. Arnold is in favor of sacrificing verbal accuracy in translation in order to bring the aesthetic effect. Arnold criticizes Newman, who believed in a literal translation. Arnold is aware of the fact that no one will now know how Homer had affected the Greeks. Therefore, he says that the true test of a good translation is when it can please someone who both knows the Greek and has an appreciation for poetry. Let us sum up now. In this lesson, we referred to what we mean by classics and have looked at a brief history of some Greek classics into English and discussed the questions these attempt to raise on the activity of translation. With regard to the activity of translation, you need to remember the difference between a literal translation as against a translation that takes into account the spirit of the original text. In the context of the translation of Greek classics, the terms Hellenizers and Modernizers have been used to indicate this difference. Remember the terms interpretation and even conversion that have been used with reference to the translation activity.
Translating the Greek classics into English. That was the lesson brought to you from English for BA third year students.
Education at your doorstep. That was a program of learning for everyone. Brought to you by Dr. B.R. Ambedkar Open University. So listeners, it's bye till our next radio lesson.